Excuse me. Thank you very much for the introduction, the invitation, the opportunity to come here and talk a little bit about my research. So indeed, I'll be talking about eternal inflation and the swampland. Everything I'll be saying today can be found in this paper that I had in May of last year. And so a quick outline. I'm going to start out, for most of the talk, giving what I hope should be a pedagogical introduction to eternal inflation and how it works, what are the conditions that are required for it. So that'll take us up through here. Then, for a little while at the end, we'll get into some more speculative ground, and I'll speculate on what this might have to do with some of the recent work on the swampland, and in particular on constraints on scalar field potentials. So, to begin, inflation describes a period of quasi-exponential expansion of the universe. So we have a metric that looks like this, ds squared equals negative dt squared plus a squared of t dx squared, the usual FRW metric. But in inflation, a of t is given approximately by e to the ht, where h is roughly constant. So it's quasi-exponential growth of the universe. In field theory, the study of inflation begins by assuming that we have some scalar field, phi, so we have the Einstein term, we have the kinetic term for phi, and then we have, excuse me, a potential. So what we do in inflation is we restrict to the case of a homogeneous scalar field. So we assume that phi of tx is just given by phi of t. And when we do this, the equation of motion for the scalar field looks like this. Phi dot, phi double dot, plus 3h phi dot, plus v prime of phi is equal to 0. And h squared is equal to 1 half phi dot squared plus v over 3. And here, and throughout my talk, I'm going to be working in units where the reduced Planck mass is set equal to 1. And I will restore it only a couple times when useful later on. Now, in order to get successful inflation, you need for the scalar field to be slowly rolling. This is what's going to drive the quasi-exponential growth of the universe. And the conditions for this to occur are known as the slow roll conditions. Which say, first of all, that the kinetic energy of the field has to be a lot smaller than its potential energy. Phi dot squared is much less than v. And you also need for this phi double dot term to be dominated by the 3h phi dot term and the gradient term, v prime. So in these, in this approximation, we can rewrite these equations as simply 3h phi dot plus v prime of phi is 0, and h squared, or I guess I should say approximately 0, and h squared is approximately v over 3. Note that this equation here is basically just the equation of a gradient descent of the scalar field in the potential. So how do you satisfy these slow roll conditions? There's two ways to do it. The first one is if this is v and this is phi, we could have some minimum of the potential. In that case, the field will just sit there. Phi dot is 0, phi double dot is 0. These equations are obviously satisfied. This is what's known as false vacuum. inflation. Second possibility, next best thing you could consider if you don't have a false vacuum, is that the potential is just very flat for some stretch. And so as the field rolls along this flat stretch of the potential with V greater than zero, the kinetic energy will be dominated by the potential energy, phi double dot will be small. And this is what's known as slow roll inflation. Now, in our universe, it's very sensible to believe that both of these have taken place at one time or another. So in the early universe, our universe seems to have undergone a period of what I'm going to call primordial inflation. And during primordial inflation, we know that the Hubble parameter was changing slightly, which means that we cannot just be sitting here in some false vacuum like this. Primordial inflation, assuming that it occurred, preceded by a mechanism sort of like this, where a field rolls slowly in some potential. Eventually, it comes down here and oscillates about some minimum, and inflation ends. The universe transitions into a radiation-dominated phase. So radiation domination happened for a while, then matter domination. But now we're living in an era of dark energy. And at least the standard picture of dark energy that I was taught was that it's likely due to a scenario like this, where we're sitting in some metastable, this at a minimum, and eventually we'll tunnel out of this into some true vacuum, and, that's the end. Of course, it's also possible to consider models of dark energy that are more like this. And indeed, this is something that we've been talking about at this conference, something that has been discussed quite a bit in recent years. These form what are known as models of quintessence, where dark energy is due not to being in some metastable de Sitter minimum, but rather being in some scenario like this. So there's the standard laws, and part of what this whole workshop is doing is trying to rethink some of these standard laws to ask questions like, is it possible that we're in some sort of quintessence scenario now? Are there alternatives even to this standard picture of primordial inflation? But there's another standard law that I want us to especially talk about today, which is something that I've heard many times. You find it both in papers. I was taught it in my intro cosmology classes, which is that once inflation starts, it never stops. And this leads us to the idea of what's known as eternal inflation. So to understand eternal inflation, the first thing we need to do is to understand stochastic inflation. And stochastic inflation works like this. Original treatment due to Starobinsky. What you do is you take the scalar field, phi of t and x, and we expand it into a classical background term and a quantum dynamical term. I'll call it delta phi. And as we expand this around the classical background, which rolls in the potential V, we get a quadratic action for these fluctuations delta phi, which means that these are going to be some Gaussian fluctuations. And what we want to do now is to define some smeared field, delta phi sub h of t, which we're going to define as the integral over these Fourier modes, sigma t k, delta phi sub k of t. So these here are just the Fourier modes of the field delta phi. And this sigma sub t is a so-called smearing function. And what it does is that it smears out the fluctuations delta phi on some region in space of radius the inverse of the Hubble scale. So this smears the field over this region. And then we can then write the two-point function of this smeared field as follows. Delta phi sub h of t minus delta phi sub h of 0 squared is equal to h over 2 pi squared times ht. And this is often stated in a different way in terms of the average size of a quantum fluctuation, delta phi sub q, over a time of order inverse Hubble. If we just plug t as equals h inverse into here, we see that the average size of these fluctuations is given by h over 2 pi. So what happens is that in a time of order h inverse, which during inflation is 1 e folding, the field fluctuates due to these quantum mechanical fluctuations by an amount of order Hubble. Now, what happens during inflation, we get these tiny little quantum fluctuations, but these modes are very, very quickly stretched out, and they very quickly become larger than the horizon size h inverse. And when this happens, the standard law is that these modes classicalize. In other words, they decohere once they exit the horizon, and so they effectively behave like classical noise. And this is the whole idea behind stochastic inflation, is to treat these quantum fluctuations as some classical Gaussian noise which backreacts on the evolution of the field phi. So effectively what this amounts to in terms of the equation of motion here, instead of having 3h phi dot plus v prime equals 0, instead the slow roll condition is going to become 3h phi dot plus v prime of phi is equal to some Gaussian noise term. And what that means is that as we roll in this potential, we have two competing effects. First of all, we have the classical rolling, but then we also have some quantum fluctuations, so that at every time step, you get a combination of some classical evolution plus some Gaussian noise, which can push you either to the left or to the right. Now, I should mention here that I think this is sort of the biggest assumption in the whole standard story that I'm going to be talking about up through point four, which is this decoherence of these modes once they exit the horizon, and our ability to treat these quantum fluctuations as effectively classical stochastic noise. So there are papers out there that you can go read which claim that this is a problem and we shouldn't actually do this. I'm going to be honest that I don't understand those papers, so maybe someone does and can explain it to me. But for today, I'm just going to assume this standard picture pioneered by Starobinsky and used by many, many people since. And so we're going to assume that this is right, and this is maybe the big assumption.
Sorry, maybe you explain, but how do you get this mirroring function? Like, did you choose it? Is there any freedom to get to choose it?
Yeah, we have the freedom to choose it as we like, so that it effectively is just computing this smearing over this region.
So
yeah.
It doesn't affect the end of t, and on the other right-hand side, it's not the
end of t. No, that's right. Because in the end, these are going to be Gaussian. We're just averaging some Gaussian fluctuations, and so we're going to get a Gaussian fluctuation. Yeah?
So it's proven that it is correct, so it's not an assumption.
Oh, so this is proven. Oh, good. Okay. Great. In that case, no assumptions whatsoever needed. Okay. So this is the idea behind stochastic inflation. Now, so what happens next? Well, what we should really be talking about now is a probability distribution for the field phi as a function of time. So this is a PDF. And it tells us what is the probability of finding the field phi at this value phi after a time t. And this probability distribution is going to evolve according to these dynamics, because there's both these quantum spreading as well as the classical evolution from v prime. And this sort of evolution is governed by a famous equation, which is known as the Fokker-Planck equation, which shows up in many different contexts in physics. The Fokker-Planck equation that specifically arises here looks like this. P dot is equal to 1/2 h over 2 pi squared times h times d phi squared of p plus 1 over 3 h d phi of d phi v p of phi t. So you can see that the evolution of this probability density function is going to depend on these two terms. The first one has this h over 2 pi, which looks familiar from the quantum fluctuations. Indeed, this first term is telling you about the evolution due to the quantum effects. If you set h bar to 0, this term would go away completely. The second term, you'll notice, has the gradient of v. So this is the classical term. This is the quantum term. And this sort of equation is, in general, sort of hard to solve. You can't do it analytically, except for in two cases, which fortunately for us are exactly the two cases that we need today. So two instances where this can be solved analytically: the case of a linear potential v, or the case of a quadratic potential v. And in both cases, the solution is a Gaussian, so it'll take this form, p of phi t is equal to 1 over sigma of t squared of 2 pi times the exponential negative phi minus mu t squared over 2 sigma of t squared. That's the ordinary form of a Gaussian. You note it depends on the two parameters, the standard deviation sigma, the mean mu, which will depend on time. And we can work these out explicitly for the cases of a linear potential and a quadratic potential. So let's do that now. So first of all, a linear potential. So v is equal to v naught minus alpha phi. Here, the solution to these equations is going to be given, to the Fokker-Planck equation, is going to be given by this Gaussian, where mu of t is equal to alpha over 3h t, and sigma squared of t is equal to h over 2 pi squared times ht. And let's draw a picture. The potential will look like this, where, of course, the height is v naught, and alpha tells us the slope. OK, so a couple things to note here. First of all, you note that this expression looks quite familiar. It's the exact same thing as this guy. So here, sigma squared tells us about the quantum diffusion. The Gaussian wave packet, if we assume that it starts off as just a delta function in some location, say here, this wave packet will just spread out. And note that this guy is actually independent of the value of alpha. We could set alpha to 0, so we just have this free field, and the spreading of this won't be affected at all. All of the quantum information is in here, whereas all the classical information is in here. Indeed, if you set h bar to 0, this expression would be exactly the same. It's just telling you that this field classically rolls down this slope. So the evolution of this wave packet is going to look sort of like this. If we start out with this delta function at some location here, as time goes on, the field's going to roll down this slope. But the wave packet's also going to spread out like this. So classical evolution pushes us down. Quantum diffusion makes this wave packet spread out. OK, second case. We'll consider the case of a tachyonic field. So V equals V naught minus m squared over 2 phi squared. We could also consider the case of a massive field where this is a plus sign, but it's not so interesting for us. Here, what's that? Because what we're looking at for are conditions for eternal inflation, and that can give us some bounds on tachyonic hilltops, but it's not going to give us bounds on masses. So here we have this potential. This is the so this is a hilltop, and here. So first of all, we'll draw the picture of the potential. It'll look, of course, like this. And from the symmetry, you can see that if we start the field at the top of this hill, we're just going to have mu of t equal to 0 for all times. But on the other hand, sigma squared of t is going to go like this, 3h to the fourth over 8 pi squared m squared minus 1 plus the exponential of 2m squared over 3h times t. So here, what's going to happen is that if we start with a wave packet that's just a delta function centered at the hill, top of the hill, classically we know we just sit there forever. But these quantum fluctuations will push us off, and so this wave packet will spread out. And it spreads out actually in this exponentially quick manner. You'll see, as t gets large, the sigma squared gets exponentially large. And the way to understand this, what happens here, is that if you're just sitting at the top here, a little quantum fluctuation will push you off, either one way or the other. But once you move off just a little bit, now the classical evolution will take over. And because we have this tachyonic hill, as soon as you're off by just a little bit, exponentially quickly you fall off the hill. OK, so this is all I wanted to say about stochastic inflation. What's that?
Just m squared phi squared.
What about it?
Is that solvable?
It is, yeah, it is. The big difference is that there'll be a minus sign in this exponential. So instead of falling off really quickly, you'll get pushed back into the minimum of that hill. Yeah, yeah. I should point out, actually, that there's an assumption that I'm making here in being able to solve this analytically, which is that I'm assuming that h is constant, which isn't going to be quite true, but as we'll see, it's a good enough approximation for what we need. Okay, so now, what does this have to do with eternal inflation? Well, when we start talking about eternal inflation, what we're really asking is how long will inflation last? The idea behind eternal inflation is that inflation is supposed to last forever. So, when we start talking about eternal inflation, what we really want to compute is the probability that inflation is still occurring after a time t. So let's start with the case of the linear potential that we talked about first. So linear potential. We have V is equal to V naught minus alpha phi. The potential looks like that. Let me redraw it here. And what will happen here, a necessary condition for inflation is that the so-called slow roll parameter, epsilon V, which is equal to 1/2 V prime over V squared, has to be much, much less than 1. This is a necessary condition for inflation. And in this particular case, this is going to be equal to 1/2 alpha squared over V squared. And since alpha is constant, but V is decreasing as we move along here, there will be some value of phi, say right here, which we'll call phi end, which is where epsilon V becomes order 1. So to the right of here, inflation has ended. To the left of here, inflation is still going on. So if we want to know what is the probability that inflation is happening after a time t, this is going to be equal to the probability that phi is less than phi end at such a time t. And this is something we can compute, because we just worked out the probability density function for the case of the linear potential. So this is equal to the integral from negative infinity to phi end of p, or our function p up there, of phi t d phi. And since this is just a Gaussian, what we're computing here, if we have this evolution of the wave packet that looks like this, what we're computing is this region here in the tail of this wave packet as it evolves. And this is going to be equal to an error function, or c, or specifically 1/2, or c of mu of t minus phi end over sigma of t times the square root of 2, where mu and sigma are given by the values that we have up there for the linear potential. So this is going to be more explicitly 1/2 erf c of alpha over 3ht minus phi end over h over 2 pi square root of ht. And in the limit, as t goes to infinity, we can expand this error function, and it's going to go like the exponential as negative 4 pi squared alpha squared t over 18 h to the fifth. So you look at this, and naively you say, well, it doesn't look like inflation is eternal. Because I can see that as t goes to infinity, this exponential is going to go to 0. And therefore, the probability that I'm still inflating at time t is also going to go to 0. So how can inflation be eternal? But the point is that there's another effect we want to consider. See, if you just fix a particular observer and ask what is the probability that inflation has ended after time t for them, then this is the right computation. You see that it goes to 0. For any given observer, inflation will end in finite time with probability 1. But if we instead think a little bit more globally about all the observers, then the question we want to ask is, what is the amount of volume of space that is still inflating at time t? This is going to be equal to the total volume times the fraction of that volume, which is still inflating, which is the probability of inflation at time t. So this guy we just worked out, it has this exponential decay. But you have to remember that because of inflation, the total amount of volume is also exponentially growing. This is given by e to the 3ht because of the scale factor expansion, which goes like e to the ht, and the factor of 3 is because it's a volume. And so that means that this guy is going to go like the exponential of 3h minus this decay, 4 pi squared alpha squared over 18h to the fifth times t. And so the question of whether or not inflation is eternal is the question of whether this volume goes to infinity or to zero. If it goes to infinity, that means that inflation will globally continue forever. There will always be these regions of space-time that are still inflating, whereas if this goes to zero, then inflation's not eternal. So this amounts to the question of whether or not this term is positive or negative. Eternal inflation happens when 3h is greater than 4 pi squared alpha squared over 18h to the fifth. And so what's happening here? How should we think about this pictorially? Well, if you start here, then classically you just roll down here and inflation ends in finite time. And so if we start out with our Hubble patch, right, should I draw this? I guess here. If we start with our own Hubble patch right here, then after some, after one E folding, after a Hubble time, we'll have this expansion due to the inflationary expansion. So we'll go from one Hubble patch to order E cubed of them in one Hubble time. And in many of these, inflation may end because the field rolls this way. So in most of these regions of spacetime, inflation will end, and they'll no longer be inflating. But in some of these regions, what will happen is that due to quantum fluctuations, you'll actually move up the potential rather than down it due to the classical fluctuations. And so in some regions of space, you'll move back up, and you'll continue to inflate. And so the same thing will happen at the next time step. These guys will inflate, and due to classical evolution, many of these regions will stop inflating, but some of them may continue to inflate. And the same thing for this guy here. Some of these regions will stop inflating, but some will continue to inflate, and so on and so forth. And already, just looking at this picture, you can sort of see that there's a fractal structure which is emerging. There's sort of this self-replication where at each time step, a bunch of regions stop inflating and give rise to pocket universes. But these pocket universes are separated by regions that are still inflating. And so this goes on indefinitely and, according to the standard law, produces this fractal-like structure at space-time, which gives rise to a multiverse. With all of these different pocket universes, perhaps governed by different laws, separated by these eternally inflating regions. And if you go one step further, you might combine this with the standard picture of the string landscape and say that this string landscape will be populated by this eternally inflating multiverse and maybe even give us an anthropic solution to some of the fine-tuning problems like the cosmological constant problem. So we'll get back to that at the end of my talk. For now, let's go back to this equation here. From this condition for eternal inflation, we can make a couple of substitutions. Alpha, recall, is equal to the negative of v prime of phi from our linear potential, whereas the Hubble equation gives h squared is equal to v over 3. So we can plug these in for alpha and h into here, and this gives us a condition for eternal inflation on the first derivative of the potential, which is that v prime over v the 3 halves is greater than, sorry, less than square root of 2 over 2 pi, 1 over m Planck cubed, where I have now reinserted the factors of m Planck. So what this is telling you is that as long as this potential is sufficiently flat, the classical evolution, which pushes you down the slope, won't be able to compete with the quantum evolution, the quantum fluctuations that push you up the slope. So as long as it's flatter than this, you'll get eternal inflation, whereas if this is sufficiently sloped, if the slope is sufficiently large, then you won't get eternal inflation, because the classical evolution down here will beat the quantum diffusion that pushes you back up. I should also say, so this, first of all, the factor of 3 halves here is pretty well known to anybody who's worked on eternal inflation. So you often will see in literature this condition v prime over v to the 3 halves is less than some order 1 number. This number, this coefficient itself, actually was even worked out in a paper by in 2008 by Cremonelli, Dubovsky, Nicolis, Senatori, and Zaldarriaga. And basically, they did a very similar analysis to what we just did here. It was slightly more sophisticated because they wanted to put, they put a boundary on the PDF here at this region, phi end, because they're saying, well, if inflation ends here, then we shouldn't really be talking about the quantum fluctuations due to inflation anymore. So we want to put a boundary here when we want to close this off. But in the end, they get the exact same result that we did from a simpler and more more explicit, easier to follow analysis. And the reason for that is that you can add these extra ingredients like they did, but at the end of the day, you'll note that all that we really needed to derive this bound was the exponential behavior of this probability with time. So there's some other power law stuff here that doesn't matter for us. You'll also notice that the precise value of phi end, where exactly we want to say that inflation ends, whether it's epsilon v equals 1 or 0.1 or 1/2 or whatever, that doesn't show up here. All that matters is this exponential behavior, which is rather universal. So in the end, it's sort of only this coefficient which shows up in the bound, and that's why their more sophisticated analysis and our more rudimentary analysis end up giving the exact same result, because it's really only this universal behavior that matters. Yeah.
Very high, I get eternal inflation. Now, if I start up very high,
that means V is going to be very large.
Exactly. And that makes this small.
Right? Yeah, so that makes this small, which means that you get eternal inflation.
Ah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, V prime doesn't change. Yeah.
I'm sure you said that, but so this is something that's handled for all kinds of potentials, or this kind of.
Well, yeah, so I'm about to generalize a little bit by considering a hilltop. But effectively, when you this is a necessary condition, because when this is violated, you're going to basically roll too quickly. And but part of what I'm pointing out here is that because there's sort of this universal behavior, it doesn't matter exactly too much what all the particular details of the potential are. What really matters is that you should look at this here, and as long as this is satisfied, or if this is violated, you won't get eternal inflation. There could be other constraints that you need to satisfy, which is what we'll get to next. But this is sort of at least a minimum condition you need for eternal inflation.
In context of eternal inflation as a way to populate the multiverse, so on the picture you drew, it's not at all obvious that these different pockets are separated by domain walls, which would be necessary. Mm-hmm. Having different constants of nature, right? So how does it appear?
Yeah. So I don't want to get too far into this because this isn't primarily the point for today. But what happens in the if you look at some of the numerical simulations of this, basically is that there are these different pocket universes are separated by these regions where inflation is still eternally going on, and so the those regions of eternal inflation, I think, act as the domain walls between these separated different regions. It would be interesting. People have studied this, but I'm not so familiar with how people conclude or how you determine whether which sort of different laws get realized in different pockets. So that's maybe something to understand further. But I can't say much about it. Yeah.
How do you know that it's a necessary condition in the layer? Because right now you just replace the value of mu and sigma for the linear potential, right?
Right.
So you said that you know it's a necessary condition for any type of potential?
Well, if you're not satisfying this at any point in the potential, then that means that you're going to be rolling too quickly. Right?
There is a simple argument just by comparing the main fluctuation size h over 5 as a quantum jump,
yeah,
with a rolling distance in a half of time.
Right.
And just roll, and when you say quantum jumping should be bigger than classical roll, you get automatically the same.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. This is exactly telling you that the quantum jumping should be the same order as the classical rolling. If you're not satisfying this anywhere, you're not going to get
original inflation.
My claim is that it should. I mean, I guess you'd have to look at more models. But my claim is that due to the universal nature of this computation, the fact that so many details get washed out, I think that this is going to be the correct coefficient. More generally, but technically speaking, if you have a model, you should really solve the Fokker-Planck equation numerically, and see what will happen. That's something that you can do.
Okay. From a tangential, but once I talked to Luca a lot about this internal inflation, and he said he wrote some paper that in principle you can always avoid internal inflation if you start changing your potential a little bit higher.
Yeah.
So here you always assume essentially the potential is the same from
yeah.
the very beginning.
Yeah, I remember that paper of his actually. Yeah. What he's doing is he's modifying the potential as you go far out so that you never get into this regime.
Yeah, but that was an argument which was made in the context of PLP inflation, where indeed it's extremely fine tuned to get into inflation.
Yeah, yeah.
But in the Hilbert models, once you have a flat maximum, there you go.
Yeah.
So
maybe this is a good segue to the next part, which is the Hilltop models. So we can do now our same analysis that we just did for the Hilltop. So v equals v naught minus 1/2 m squared phi squared. In this case, we have a hill that looks like this, and inflation will end when you get too far off of the plateau. So we'll say this is negative phi end, and this is phi end, and inflation occurs as long as you're between here and here. So the probability of inflating after time t is going to be equal to the probability that negative phi end is less than phi, which is less than phi end, which is equal to the integral from negative phi end to phi end of p of phi t d phi. And now we can plug in this probability density function with mu 0 and sigma squared given by this value into here. And this is going to give us a different error function, ERF, because we're now computing this region in the middle of the probability density function of the Gaussian. It's the error function of phi end minus mu of t over sigma of t on the square root of 2 for again this value of sigma, this value of mu, and you plug this in, and you approximate as t goes to infinity, this is going to go like the exponential of negative m squared over 3h times t. So once again, we want to ask, will this go on eternally? And so we need to compare this exponential decay. And fortunately, we get another exponential decay with time. So the inflating volume at time t is going to be given by the exponential of 3h minus m squared over 3h t. And so if we want to, so eternal inflation will happen if this is positive. 3h is greater than m squared over 3h. Or using the fact that negative m squared is equal to v double prime, and h squared is equal to v over 3, this is the same as the condition that v double prime over v is greater than negative 3 over m Planck squared. So as long as this hilltop isn't too tachyonic, we'll get eternal inflation. If it's flat, or if v double prime is positive, answering Arrhenius' question, if v double prime is positive, so that it has a positive mass squared, then you'll just sit there and you'll eternally inflate. But if the hilltop is sufficiently tachyonic, so it's very steeply curved like this, you can actually violate the condition, and so you don't get eternal inflation. So a couple, maybe one remark is in order, which is that you notice that in the linear case, the way that we got eternal inflation was that the quantum fluctuations actually pushed us up the potential and allowed us to eternally inflate, even though classical ruling would have pushed us off. Here, in a sense, it's a little bit like the opposite, because classically, if you just start at the hilltop, you sit there forever. But the quantum fluctuations can actually push you off. So it's a little bit less intuitive than the linear picture, where we can just compare the size of the quantum fluctuations in the classical evolution and ask which one's bigger, and as long as quantum fluctuations win, eternal inflation happens. Here it's a little bit more complicated, because if you set h bar to 0, you actually eternally inflate. Okay, so these are the two main conditions that I wanted to write down for eternal inflation. As I say, this one's appeared in the literature before. This one I actually think has not appeared, at least with this order one coefficient. But we see that you can actually get them both quite nicely from this very simple analysis of the Fokker-Planck equation. We can solve things analytically. We don't even need to make these great approximations, as people have sometimes in the past. Yeah, yeah. No, order of magnitude certainly known. I would like to be pointed out to where that is in literature. I'm sure, yes, it certainly has. But there have been, I've found papers on this recently where people made approximations and got things that are sort of like this. My point is that you don't need to make approximations. You can solve the Fokker-Planck equation analytically.
But I think this has been done by Blenkin and by
Lindbergh. I actually found different statements about this from Blenkin. So I think that's, so I don't know if I agree. But if you can point it out to me, I'd love to see it. I mean, I saw him, I've seen papers by him where he says that any hilltop will give you eternal inflation. And that's not true, as we've seen.
No, you need that condition
I
mean, as a way of viewing this, you could say that you start from the top, you jump by 8 over 2 pi, and probably when you are that far away, this condition tells you that then epsilon is already bigger than v.
Morally, yes. Morally, yes.
That's why, how you can think about it.
Yeah. No, I understand morally you can think about it that way. Yeah. My point is just we can get these analytical solutions. They give us exact answers. Things are nice. Okay. So let's move on now to part 4, which is primordial inflation. So let's take these bounds for eternal inflation and ask, what happens if we apply them to actual models of the early universe? So I'll just quickly write down a couple of models, their potentials, and we'll ask, are they eternal? So first of all, we can write down the chaotic or power law. Models of inflation, V is alpha phi to the P. So are these eternal? And the answer is yes. If phi is larger than about 1,000 M Planck, with a precise value depending on P, and no otherwise. And here, note that by saying primordial inflation, I'm imposing constraints from observation on these models. More generally, you could imagine a situation where you can eternally inflate with a smaller value of phi, but if so, it cannot agree with observations of our early universe. So if you impose observational constraints, you get these bounds. And in general, you know, this is a swampland workshop. We're quantum gravity people. We recognize that typically quantum gravity will make it very hard to achieve a super Planckian traversal. We expect that once quantum gravity effects are turned on, maintaining a flat inflaton potential for distances of order 1,000 M Planck or larger will be extremely difficult. In fact, even maintaining it for the distances of order 10 M Planck or 15 M Planck that are necessary to make these models work and agree with the experiment could already be difficult in and of itself. So what this means is that, is it eternal? Probably not. It's probably very hard to actually achieve this sort of a model over these sorts of distances.
So you say you're imposing something about our units. Are you imposing like Planck data or something?
Yeah, Planck data. So in particular, here the size of the primordial, the power spectrum, AS goes like 10 to the minus 9, sets this value alpha. Yeah. I'm imposing that P is between something like a quarter and two. And the value of P will affect this number here, but it's always going to be an order of 1,000 or something. It's quite large. Okay, so probably not. How about hilltop models? So here, V is equal to V naught minus 1/2 m squared phi squared plus lambda phi cubed plus dot, dot, dot. So we've just seen that in general, this depends on whether, on how tachyonic the hilltop is. So if m squared here is sufficiently large, it won't be eternal. If m squared is small, it will be eternal. But here we need to impose the constraint that the spectral index in our universe is pretty close to 1. And once you impose that, you conclude that these models are necessarily going to be eternal. So if you impose agreement with observation, a hilltop model must be eternal. Finally, the last model I want us to talk about are the small field inflection point models. So here we have V naught plus alpha phi plus lambda phi cubed plus dot, dot, dot. And again, at a generic inflection point in the landscape, you may have eternal inflation or you may not. It depends really on the size of alpha over V naught to the 3/2, because as we saw, this V prime over V to the 3/2 is the thing that tells you whether or not you're inflating eternally. So if this is sufficiently small, you get eternal inflation. If it's not, you don't. But again, imposing constraints in our universe, specifically that the spectrum, that the power spectrum is very small, this is actually a direct measurement of the size of quantum fluctuations to classical fluctuations. So the fact that this is 10 to the minus 9 means that the classical fluctuations are much smaller than the classical rolling. And so as a result, in order to agree with the experiment, these are not going to be eternal near the inflection point. So the main thing I want to point out here is that just that contrary to maybe what's sometimes said, it's not in general true that just about any model of inflation that you write down is going to be eternal. Some models are, some models are not, some models, it depends. It's very possible to write down a successful model of inflation that is eternal. It's also very possible to write down one that isn't. Yeah.
For the small scale, the inflection point ones, I mean, if you impose some kind of whatever assumption that the next higher term beyond the linear one, say quartic or sextic, then even for the linear coefficient to zero, you get an S which can be compatible.
With eternal. With data.
And the linear term to zero, the coefficient. And then you say minus 5 to the 4 or minus 5 to the 6.
Okay.
Then an S is going back to 0.98.
Okay, thanks. Okay, so you're saying, okay, so if you tune some of these higher coefficients, you can actually make it work. Okay, thanks.
But just further along the potential, you see.
When I'm talking about this, I'm really talking about specifically near the inflection point.
That's right.
Right. So you may, I mean, who knows, you know, you may have an inflection point and then over here you just have some nice hilltop and you obviously eternally inflate here. I'm specifically asking, are we getting eternal inflation near the point where
exactly.
Where observations probe?
All I'm saying,
yeah.
The lamppost also in the landscape don't seem to be like that.
Okay, thanks. Okay, so let's see, how am I doing on time? Okay, so I want to shift gears now, and so what I've just said, I think is pretty standard, nothing too wild. Now I want to get into slightly more speculative regimes, and start talking about what could this mean for the swampland. So first of all, let's turn around what we said. So far we've talked about conditions for eternal inflation. Let's turn around and ask, what are conditions for no eternal inflation? How do we avoid eternal inflation? And there are a few ways that you can do this. So the first one, as we've just seen, if v prime over v to the 3/2 is larger than the square root of 2 over 2 pi 1 over m Planck squared, then we won't eternally inflate. Similarly, we have a bound on v double prime. If v double prime over v is less than negative 3 over m Planck squared, we won't eternally inflate. Now, both of these deal with the case of single field. In my paper, you can see how this generalizes to multiple fields. The nice thing about the quadratic and linear potentials is that there, once again, even in the case of multifield, you can still solve them analytically. The Gaussian just factorizes into a product of Gaussians over the different directions. And so in these cases, what you can have is that some combination of these guys is sufficiently large. So some combination of the gradient and the negative eigenvalues of the Hessian. So here I'm going to sum over only the negative eigenvalues of the Hessian, so the tachyonic directions. as long as this is satisfied, again, we'll avoid eternal inflation. Just a combination of these two.
Sorry, was that computation stream on the other
one? Yes. Yeah, yeah. Good. Yeah. I am assuming canonically normalized scalar fields.
I'm so confused. You derive these specific cases from linear and quadratic.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you imagining these hold much more general?
Yeah, yeah. So the claim is that these conditions need to be satisfied. At least one of them will need to be satisfied at a given point, because otherwise you can eternally inflate there. But I mean, it's sort of a local question, right? Because if I just have a region here where it's flat enough, and I have some wave packet which is centered there, other crazy stuff could be happening to the left or right. But as long as this potential is sufficiently flat here, I'm going to have quantum fluctuations are going to keep me there.
Imagine you're looking at location.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. It could be that there are slight differences. One should in principle study this for other models, but my claim is that this sort of a local analysis should capture the relevant physics.
And that's why this linear and quadratic.
Hence these linear and quadratic bounds. That's right. Yeah. Okay, so a fourth possibility, which I didn't get into today, is that there could be some higher order, some higher derivative instability. So we looked at linear potentials and hilltop potentials, which gave us bounds on the first and second derivatives. You consider cubic models, quartic models, and so forth. In that case, you can't solve the Fokker-Planck equation analytically, but you can do it numerically. And so you can see my paper, I did that. I found bounds on the third derivatives, fourth derivatives, et cetera. Yeah?
When you say that you can do it for multiple fields, are you assuming somehow that this is kind of addition of various potential terms?
Yeah, so because I'm... So here in driving this, I'm assuming a linear, or that it's just a quadratic potential with possibly some linear terms. And because of that... That sort of thing has enough symmetry, right? That if I'm just looking at the quadratic eigenvalues of the Hessian, I can just look at the different eigendirections, and then things are pretty nicely behaved. Yeah. So it's because of that assumption that I'm doing this local analysis and only computing the up to the second derivatives that I can make those sort of nice statements. Yeah. Okay. So fourth higher derivative instability, and then the last one is. You could actually imagine that you still have, that you violate all of these guys. So you actually have a de Sitter minimum, which is metastable, as long as it's not too metastable. So in particular, you need for the decay rate in Hubble units to be order 1 or larger. That means that you're decaying out of this minimum faster than you can inflate. So these are the five conditions. As long as you're satisfying one of these guys, you should be able to avoid eternal inflation, but you have to satisfy them everywhere, right? It's not just like at one point in the potential you satisfy one of these, it's everywhere in the potential. So these are conditions for no eternal inflation. Now let me switch gears a little bit and bring up some of the refined de Sitter conjectures that Kamran and other people have been making over the last couple of years. So Kamran talked about these in his talk yesterday morning. The original de Sitter conjecture is just the statement that V prime over V should be greater than some number of order 1 in Planck units. The refined de Sitter conjecture, this was Kamran and Georges and others around this paper, later went with Hiroshi, Gary and Iran, is that either this is satisfied or the second derivative is less than negative some order 1 number in Planck units.
The refined ones were conjectured by others.
Oh, that's right. Thanks. Garg, I think, and maybe some other people. Yeah, sorry. So some other ones. There's actually another refined de Sitter conjecture due to David Andriot, where he wanted to consider a linear combination of these things. So specifically, the bound he wrote down was that M Planck times the gradient plus A Planck squared times the minimum eigenvalue Hessian is greater than or equal to B, where here A, B, and Q are some order one numbers that Andriot constrained by looking at classical De Sitter vacua, or classical De Sitter maxima that have been constructed in string theory. Okay, so so these are the conjectures that were written down by recent people, by people recently, and well, they have ended up being rather controversial conjectures amongst the whole landscape of swampland conjectures. These are maybe the ones that have led to the most vigorous debate. And I think that's for pretty good reason, which is, first of all, they would have very interesting implications, if true, most of all, forbidding metastable De Sitter minima. But they're also conjectures that have, I would say, sort of a rather large list of both pros and cons. So there's some good things going for, there's some bad things going against them. Let's make a little list. Where should we do this? I guess up here. Okay, so what are the nice things going for the De Sitter conjectures? What are some reasons to believe in them? First of all, there are the arguments against stable De Sitter in string theory. Most people generally seem to believe that you can't have exactly stable De Sitter in string theory. And if you believe this, it's maybe not so crazy to go one step further and say that there shouldn't be metastable De Sitter either. There's also no-go results in weakly coupled string theory. There's old arguments, famously due to Dine and Seiberg, that De Sitter, metastable De Sitter minima, if they exist in string theory, have to occur in strongly coupled limits. And I think this is at the least what we should say about these De Sitter conjectures is that they're very likely to be true in weak coupling limits in string theory. And indeed, in this paper by in the refined paper by Kumrein, Aran, Hiroshi, and Gary, they very explicitly say we think that these are true in weakly coupled limits in string theory, and they're more agnostic about whether or not they hold in the interior as well, in more strongly coupled limits. So third of all, the last one I'll mention, is the difficulty in constructing well-controlled counterexamples in string theory. And I'll mention some of these these purported counterexamples in the cons column momentarily. Most famously, of course, is the KKLT construction. But there are other constructions that have been written down as well, the large volume scenario, et cetera. What you have to say at the least, though, is that these constructions have many moving parts, things that aren't understood too well. At the very least, there's no simple harmonic oscillator for De Sitter in string theory. So it's at least plausible to say that maybe these difficulties are telling us something. Maybe they're trying to tell us that quantum gravity just doesn't like De Sitter. Okay, well, now what are the cons with the De Sitter conjectures? So the first thing I'll mention is observational evidence for inflation. And a couple things need to get mentioned here. First of all, is that it's conceivable that inflation is wrong. There are sort of problems with even the best models of inflation. But on the other hand, inflation has made predictions that have been subsequently borne out by experiment. So you have to give inflation some credit for sure. Furthermore, although there are alternatives to inflation, none of them seem to have had nearly as much success as inflation so far. So you can imagine that there's something else out there, but inflation seems to be the best thing that people have written down. It should also be noted that the de Sitter conjectures maybe aren't technically incompatible with inflation. There have been a lot of papers over the last couple of years written by people trying to write down models of inflation that are consistent with the de Sitter conjectures. And as far as I can tell, you can do it. You can write down some models of warm inflation and stuff like this. But at the least, there seems to be some tension with the statements. After all, these are the basically bounds on the first and second slow roll parameters. And so these are, they maybe don't rule out all models of inflation, but they certainly seem to point in that direction. And I think that's sort of by intention, that they're supposed to put some tension onto inflation. So second con.
What do you mean by intention?
I mean,
okay.
My understanding was that there's sort of some that there's some issue or there's some incompatibility between the Sitter conjectures and inflation, and that's not something that you're trying to resolve. Maybe I'm wrong.
We get whatever we get, so it does not
by intention. Okay. In that case, I retract that comment. The next one I'll say is observational evidence for dark energy. So we know from CMB data, from supernovae data, that our universe seems to have a positive cosmological constant. The universe seems to be expanding at an accelerating rate. And it's possible to do this consistently with the de Sitter conjectures. Namely, instead of having a metastable de Sitter minimum, you could imagine that we have one of these quintessent scenarios that I mentioned earlier. But the problem with this is that quintessence seems to be at least as difficult to achieve in string theory as de Sitter does. So at the very least, if you want to try to use the problems with constructing de Sitter minima in string theory as arguments in favor of the de Sitter conjectures, you must also use the difficulty of constructing quintessence models as evidence against the conjectures. Because at the end of the day, one of these guys has got to be right, and both of them seem really hard to do in string theory. The third one is, I again should mention, the claimed constructions of de Sitter, most famously KKLT, which, as I say, they have a lot of moving parts. They could be wrong, but on the other hand, nobody has yet been able to identify a really precise problem and demonstrate it compellingly that this is a problem. And throughout the years, the last 15 years or so since KKLT, there have been challenges which have subsequently been addressed. So at the least, you have to give KKLT some credit, even though it may, in the end, prove to be incorrect. But then maybe, at least to me, what seemed, when I first saw the de Sitter conjectures, one of the biggest issues was the lack of a really compelling physical motivation. What Cumran and friends did was that they looked at examples in string theory, and they found features and conjecture that these should apply more generally. And this, of course, is a sensible thing to do as scientists. We look at some data set, we note some trend, we ask ourselves, is this trend there for a reason? Will it continue more generally? But what we'd really like is a more direct physical motivation. And for contrast, let me mention another swampland conjecture, which is my personal favorite, the weak gravity conjecture. And the weak gravity conjecture says that when you have some U1 gauge theory coupled to gravity on the landscape, there should exist a particle of charge Q, mass M, that satisfies Q over M. It's greater than or equal to Q over M for an extremal black hole, which is equal to some order 1 number in Planck units, which is known. You can actually compute this number explicitly. For instance, in 4 dimensions, it's just the square root of 2. with the weak gravity conjecture, there is something sharp and physical that happens when you violate this conjecture. Namely, you get a tower of stable extremal black holes. So when you violate this conjecture, you get that tower. When you satisfy the conjecture, you don't get that tower. Now, it's not obvious that there's something wrong with having a tower of stable extremal black holes. But at the very least, there is something very physically different between a theory that satisfies this conjecture and one that violates it. And so you might think that maybe this tower of stable extremal black holes is something that quantum gravity might have a problem with. And then, well, here we are a few years later, and we actually have all these different arguments given by many people in this room as to why the weak gravity conjecture should be true. In contrast here, there isn't anything obviously different between a theory that marginally satisfies the de Sitter conjectures and one that marginally violates them. And relatedly, there isn't a sharp coefficient in any of these statements. There are just these order one factors. So it would be nice if we could address this. And with this, now, let me bring us back to where we started with the conditions for no eternal inflation. So the first thing to note is that if, as long as you don't squint too much, there are some pretty remarkable relations between the things on this side of the board and this side of the board. So here we have this derivative, this constraint on the first derivative of the potential. Here we have a constraint on the first derivative. Here we have a constraint on the second derivative. Here's another constraint on the second derivative. Here we have some linear combination of the two. Here we have a linear combination of the two. There are, of course, some differences between these two conjectures. They're not the same thing. Most notably, by far, is the fact that here we have a v to the 3 halves, and here we have just a v. And since v is going to be smaller than m Planck, this condition is going to be strictly stronger than this one. So this will imply this guy. As long as c prime, this order one number, is 3 or larger, this guy will imply this one. So for suitable choices, this guy will apply this. And also relatedly, for suitable choices of these Q, A, and B, this guy here will imply this one. And so the point is that for suitable coefficients in these bounds, the de Sitter conjectures are strictly stronger than the no eternal inflation bounds. So, let's see. There's a few different ways that we can react to this. A few different things could be going on here. The first one, so options. Number one, it could be, I think the most basic thing, what most people would agree with, is that these bounds are at least true in weakly coupled string theory. So if it's true that the RDSC is true in weakly coupled string theory, then what that tells us is that eternal inflation is a strongly coupled quantum gravity phenomenon.
So John, can I just ask for this? Because you said this a couple of times that most people would agree these holding weakly coupled string theory.
Yeah.
And sort of the constructions like KKL, yes, you know, they're designed to try and end up in a region between small G string and small alpha prime.
Yeah, I guess what I mean here is asymptotically. I mean, In those cases, you can have G string too small, right? So I guess it depends on what your definition of weakly coupled is. In principle, consistent with KKLT, though?
Well, certainly consistent with LDS.
Cameron's shaking his head.
Take the weak coupling limit, it's going to be far out. At some point, it will be
Yeah, okay. Yeah, okay, so I guess I should say, so strongly coupled here needs to be taken with a grain of salt, depending on what you're, or where you find this crossover point to be. But at least it's not something which occurs in arbitrarily weakly coupled regions. So,
I think there's also a naming thing, because when you say weakly coupled string theory, you always think of like, you have a weak coupling constant of string theory. But I think the statement is true more generally, that in sort of in every limit which you can have, which kind of might first come to something more crazy than having weak coupling of string theory. You know what I'm getting at?
I think so, yeah.
Asymptotic means.
Yeah.
So asymptotically. In field space, which might not be the coupling constant.
Right. Okay.
So you mean any kind of symmetry in sort of classical?
Well, I don't think classical limit in which sense.
This range bar.
So there might be some classical parameter in the theory that you can take as an expansion parameter. And this could be also, I don't know, large N or whatever.
Okay, so I should maybe point out that this actually sort of agrees fairly nicely with the last paper of Stephen Hawking with Thomas Hertog, where they want to argue that eternal inflation actually is necessarily some strongly coupled quantum gravity phenomenon and produces a very different picture than the usual fractal-like structure that we've talked about today. I'm not qualified to comment on it, but it's something that maybe has some sort of parallel. Now, the second option is just that, from weakest to strongest, it could be that the De Sitter conjectures are just true for some deep fundamental reason of quantum gravity, and I don't understand what that is, but maybe there's something that explains why they are true, and if so, then what we've seen is that no eternal inflation follows as a consequence. But I think the third possibility, which is maybe the most intriguing, is that maybe, in fact, no eternal inflation is sort of the deep underlying physical principle which explains why the refined De Sitter conjectures are approximately true. Because if no eternal inflation is true, then we would expect that one of these conditions should hold everywhere in the landscape. And so maybe it's not so crazy that we start seeing conditions a little bit like this. In other words, maybe no eternal inflation is the correct refinement of the De Sitter conjectures.
But the first condition is much weaker.
Much weaker. Yeah, that's right. In fact, that's what I want to get back to now. So I'm running out of time. I have 5 minutes, I think. I was told I had an hour and a half, right? This is still true? Okay. Good. So let me be clear at this point. I wanted to say this. I do not consider this to be a theorem of quantum gravity. I do not consider this to be a well-supported conjecture. This is a supposal. Supposing that that eternal inflation, for whatever reason, is just incompatible with quantum gravity, what would it mean?
But the word, so it's not a physical motivation, I'm saying. It's just a condition you can still state.
It's a condition you can state. But let me point out, well,
Frank came over, there's a physical argument.
Okay.
People can believe or not.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah, I'll get back to that at the end. Yeah.
Sorry, in the asymptotic region of field space in the experiment, where B exponentially decays, how could that condition be compromising for like Noble theorems in the asymptotic region? Would that condition be compromising for B?
Not.
Repeat the question.
In the asymptotic region of field space, we have Noble theorems that state B prime over B are greater than.
Yeah.
How could this be the fundamental reason for
building? It's tough to see how that is for me, at least at the moment.
Because I mean, it's strictly weaker.
Yeah. It does seem strictly weaker. It seems like it's hard, like it's not getting you exactly where you want. So.
What I'm saying is that it might be more plausible to have some condition that in the interior look like that, but at least in the asymptotic region, no-go theorems that are conformed.
Yeah. I agree. The no-go theorems are stronger than the statement no eternal inflation. I don't know how to explain why. There could be some additional thing. I'm not. I'm speculating enough. I don't want to speculate anymore. Yeah.
Is my content clear? There is no straight no-vote theorem for the asymptotic region yet. Okay, that's something.
Yeah, but well, there's a trickier construction that, like, in a lot of them, there we have.
Close to the gap, I would say, right?
It's close.
Yeah.
We haven't yet closed the gap. Okay.
Thanks. Okay, so let me go back to this supposal. Supposing, for whatever reason, that I don't know, that eternal inflation is just outlawed. How could this address some of these cons? So the first one, as it was just pointed out, is that there are no phenomenological constraints on inflation from no eternal inflation. We ended point four of my talk on primordial inflation by actually looking at models like inflection point models that agree with observation, but which aren't eternal. So it's perfectly compatible to have that. Another nice thing is that you can not only have quintessence models, but also metastable de Sitter minima, as long as they aren't too metastable. Remember, as long as the lifetime is of order Hubble, which maybe is kind of hard to believe, given what we know about particle physics in our own universe. Given that we've been around for order Hubble, it seems like you would take some coincidences to ensure that our universe will end within timescale of order Hubble. But on the other hand, this could also be viewed positively as a partial solution, at least to the cosmic coincidence problem of why we exist now rather than much later after many, many, many Hubble times. It doesn't really address the claimed de Sitter constructions. If no eternal inflation is correct, one could imagine that the ingredients of KKLT are correct, that their correct construction of the minimum is correct, because, again, it's possible to have de Sitter minima consistent with this, with no eternal inflation. But it would also mean that the lifetime computed by KKLT is much, much, much larger than the actual lifetime. So parts of it would tell us that parts of it are wrong. Parts of it could be right. But then maybe the thing that to me is most attractive about the no eternal inflation relative to the de Sitter conjectures is that here we actually have a sharp physical motivation. Something goes, the universe is very different if it satisfies eternal inflation versus if it doesn't. At least eternal inflation leads to a very different late time structure. And as I said, I don't have a good deep fundamental reason as to why eternal inflation should be outlawed. But it does seem like the sort of thing that quantum gravity might have a problem with. So again, I'll remind you how the weak gravity conjecture works. It's not obvious that there's something wrong with a tower of stable extremal black holes, but we say that's the sort of thing quantum gravity might have a problem with, and it's been fruitful to consider that line of reasoning. Here, it's the same sort of thing, where this is a sharp physical thing, namely eternal inflation, which quantum gravity might have a problem with, and if so, it would presumably lead to bounds like the ones that we have here. So I should mention that since my work on this, Kamran and Alec and other people here have introduced this new conjecture, which is sort of like the de Sitter conjectures, but also has more of a physical underlying motivation called the Trans-Planckian cosmic censorship conjecture. And it sounds like right now, Kamran and friends are actually working on this and maybe and have found some interesting connections, perhaps even with the Trans-Planckian cosmic censorship and no eternal inflation. So perhaps stay tuned for that. Okay, I'm over time, but let me just end briefly by talking, by just making some remarks on this possibility. So I made this supposal. What if eternal inflation is just wrong? What if it's illegal for some reason? Yes, a question?
Yeah. Construction gives you seemingly allowance for eternal inflation. You shouldn't trust it if it's done weakly coupled in that regime where you allow it. Still, you won't completely have to argue. You will get the same consequence.
Right. I guess what I should say is no stochastic eternal inflation. Right. It could be that there's some sort of eternal inflation which is just a very different picture than the standard one. But even that would be very interesting. Right. If this standard picture isn't right. Okay. So. Okay, so let me just make some remarks. So the big question, right, is then, it's actually reasonable to think that maybe eternal inflation is in the swampland. What I'll mention is that this is something that's been considered, at least by many people before. I'm certainly not the first one to say this, to postulate this. It's been discussed by people like Don Page, Guy Devalli, Tom Banks. There's a very interesting paper by Arkani Hamed, Dubovsky, Senatori, and Villadoro, where they ask this question, what if eternal inflation is not compatible with quantum gravity? And they debate it, and the authors actually don't even come to a consensus on this, so you can go see what they have to say. I think at the end of the day, it seems to me, if I had to pick one or the other, I'd say probably eternal inflation is in the landscape. And there are a couple of reasons why you might like it. First one, as I mentioned, it seems to give an anthropic solution to the cosmological constant problem, which some people like. Maybe, at least to me, more seriously, is the fact that to ensure that all of these conditions are satisfied everywhere in the landscape seems like it would take some rather remarkable tuning, some rather remarkable coincidences from the perspective of effective field theory. On the other hand, though, I think there are at least a few points that are worth noting. Regarding this, the landscape anthropic solution to the cosmological constant problem, it's not obvious to me that this is even a problem for physics as opposed to metaphysics. The question of why the laws in our universe are the way they are is not necessarily something that we as physicists have to be too concerned about. The other point is that although, yes, it seems like it would require some rather remarkable coincidences to ensure that these conditions are satisfied and that eternal inflation is forbidden, it should also be noted that deep fundamental principles of nature often appear as rather remarkable coincidences from the perspective of another, often less fundamental theory. So for instance, consistency with black hole physics implies some rather remarkable statements about the sizes, the volumes, and degeneracies of Clausius cycles, which would seem incredible from the perspective of pure geometry. The mass of the electron seems like it's very finely tuned until you know about the positron, and even that might seem like a remarkable coincidence, just this particle with the exact same mass and opposite charge, until you know about the CPT theorem. Even Kepler's second law might seem like a rather remarkable coincidence until you know about Newtonian gravitation. So in the case at hand, it could be that some deep fundamental principle of quantum gravity, for instance, holographic principle, something like this, might tell us that the sort of fractal-like asymptotic structure of spacetime that we find in eternal inflation is just not allowed. And if so, that might very well manifest as a remarkable coincidence from the perspective of effective field theory. Thank you.